CliffCentral.com.
All right. It is Tuesday morning, 15th of November. Simpiwe is here with me. We are busy going through some of the messages. We want to hear from you also on the WhatsApp line if you've got something you want to tell us there. A couple of those that I've got to play for you just now that Ryan sent to me last night. Mapelo's got something to say there too. First of all, though, we have to tell you that there's lots of interesting feedback here for JJ Cornish. He's always good. If you want to send us any info that our regular guests might need to hear, or you've got a question for them, you can do that too. You can get hold of us on contact@cliffcentral.com. It's contact@cliffcentral.com, and we will forward that to whoever, you know, whether it's one of the people from Revix who joins us regularly. A lot of people talking about cryptocurrencies, especially with that that situation, FTX this week. I was going to talk to Vinny Lingham about this because he's going to join us at some point in the not too distant future, because people are furious about what's happened with this exchange that collapsed, basically. This guy who has defrauded people. And this is not a great story for people who believe in crypto. And we'll have to find out from the guys at Revix what they think of it too, because there are people who we rely on for this information. But if you've got a question for them, you've got a question for, JJ Cornish, you let us know. And we'll make sure that they get them. All right, Simpiwe, a couple of things to talk about. Let's get to this story. And Gareth, when are you guys going on holiday in December, says Elon? Well, I think I addressed that earlier. We're all working right up to the 23rd. Friday the 23rd will be our last show for this year. So we're doing the whole of December. Don't worry, we're going to be here, right, Simpiwe?
Yes, well, you might be here. I'll be on leave. I've booked my leave and I'll be out living my best life in December.
Are you going away?
No, I love being in Joburg in December. It's quiet. There's hardly anyone around. The restaurants are empty. You get to party it up and no one sees you. So the best place to be in December is in Joburg. It is, honestly. And it's a different vibe. It's such a different vibe. Mm. And, you know, if there's one thing about they live up to the December thing. You know, you always need to be ready. That phone call, hey, where you at? I'm 5 minutes out. It's so real.
Mm-hmm. And you can get to where you need to go with no traffic. That's my favorite thing in December. It's also the place is clear. Like the roads are open and everything's still going, but there aren't as many people around. It actually is quite nice. Ruth says, don't feel alone. I couldn't agree more. December is dope in December. But I think what you mean there is maybe Joburg is dope in December. But yes, I hear you. And then this is an interesting one from John Bad Dog, referring to the FTX collapse. Second biggest donor to the Democratic Party. Well, that's interesting. Elon also wants you to know this. Nyaupe addicts will be around too, Simpiwe. So you've got to be careful of them. But then they're around all year round. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, like you just, you know, this is sad. You know the demons that you're going to be dealing with. You know you're going to be dealing with the Nogata who's going to, you're going to deal with the Nogata who's going to help you park your car. And now you have to tip him, you know, all the time. You're going to have to deal with the fact that there's hardly anybody around. You're going to have to deal with the fact that people are going to call you because jiggy, you have to pay for school fees. That's happening in January. Like, you already know the stresses that come with December. Just here for the vibes. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see what 2023 has to serve us. But enjoy December. And talking about vibes.
Yes.
I know that you like a big music lover, Gareth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I recently read an article that kind of is like, the music you listen to or like actually can tell us a bit about your personality.
Oh, really? Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I do think that it reveals something about you. If you ask someone what music they listen to and they only listen to one very narrow genre, like a specific kind of dance music, you're like, well, this person can't be very interesting.
Yeah. So here's the personality traits that you may have. If you listen to pop, they say you'll be more extroverted, honest, and you're a conventional person. I hardly listen to pop, so that's not for me. If you're into rap and hip-hop like myself, then despite the stereotype that rap lovers are aggressive or violent, our research has shown that it has no link. Rap fans tend to have a high self-esteem and are generally more outgoing than fans of other styles.
Yeah, I don't think rap
rap listeners are aggressive. I don't think that's right.
I don't know. But if you listen to country, all right, these fans typically identify as hardworking, outgoing, and very conservative.
These are all pretty straightforward, though, so far.
If you're into rock or heavy metal, then you are often someone who projects images of anger and aggression. However, the study found such fans to be gentle, creative, and introverted. They also tend to have a low self-esteem.
Sorry, I'm not sure about that. I'm just going to make a prediction here that none of these are going to be really bad because... You know, they don't want to, like, piss off a whole segment. Where did you get this article from? Just out of interest. This is BuzzFeed. Oh, God. Yeah, because, you know, people are like, well, there's no music choice that indicates anything negative ever. It's all good. Everyone on this list is going to have something that they can take away that makes them feel better. It's like those astrological charts that they give you, right, where they say to you, oh, you're a Virgo. You're going to have a great year. And you look at all the others. You look at all the others on the chart, and they also like, oh, you can have a great year. So what, there's no one who's going to have a shit year here on this lineup? It's amazing.
No. Well, okay, if you listen to indie, maybe this will – indie fans, they tend to be intellectual and creative, but they also tend to suffer from anxiety and have low self-esteem.
Oh, boy.
That's a negative, but that's indie. And then –
I don't even know
any.
I don't even know any indie people. Like, who listens to indie? That was a thing in the 90s, I reckon. I don't know if that's a thing anymore, is it?
You know, it is a thing. There's a lot of indie people just, you know, the type of people that go to Rocking the Daisies as well. They have that indie vibe. We just, like, you listen to music that's just a bit off, that nobody knows. And we're just like, what's that, Chief? Nah. Yeah, indie people, you know? But then you have people that listen to dance. All right. And those who prefer dance music are typically outgoing, assertive, and open to experience, but rank lower than others in gentleness. All right, maybe. Mm-hmm. Classical music. I don't know if anyone's ever listened to classical music. Classical music lovers are genuinely somewhat introverted, but at ease with themselves. You know, healthy self-esteem, and they're very creative. And then last but not least, we have jazz, blues, and soul. These are extroverted with high self-esteem. Those that tend to be very creative, intellectual, and at ease. All right. And this study was brought to you by Very Well Mind.
Okay.
That's where I got that.
So, yeah, I mean, some of this, like, obviously, if you like dance music, you're going to be outgoing, right? Because otherwise, why would you listen to dance? Who listens to dance music on their own? So, Sibanda says, Simpiwe will just misbehave and get thrown out of parties, like always in December. So, Sibanda's read through your stories.
I'm trying to be a better person. That's not what we're doing this year. We're just going to enjoy the vibes. We're going to enjoy, you know, some new music and just go.
Yeah. See, Jared.
That's it.
Jared and Jean here both say the same thing that I was thinking of. I'm a fan of like four of those categories. So what does that say about me? Am I all of those things or none of them? You know, that's the question. Unfortunately, these things
you're
are
probably
not clear.
All. You know, yeah. Like a chakalaka where it has different ingredients but still tastes good. So you're everything. You're a mixed masala, Gareth. It's okay.
I reckon
it means you blend in well with other people.
I reckon where these studies or these articles are useful, and really they have to actually base it on some research because otherwise it does sound like an astrological chart. Where they're useful is telling you about, for example, the way people behave in traffic. Like they've shown time and time again that if you listen to very high tempo stuff when you're driving, it does make you more anxious. And probably it makes you drive a little bit worse. So I think that's where it's interesting. But as for the rest of it, I don't know. I mean, it just sounds like it's very if you're a Leo,
wishy-washy,
and you're born yeah. with the moon rising, then you must be this. And I'm just like, that's some bullshit.
Well, we'll see. Like, I do, but I won't lie. I judge people according to what they listen to. Like, I listen to a lot of music, but there's also some artists out there. I'm like, you listen to what? To yeah. who? Yeah. You. Mm. And then there's also people that I don't understand how they could listen to rap, because I'm like, you don't look like the type that listens to hip hop. Like,
be surprised. Yeah.
I can't see it.
I got this from Mapelo, who wants to know something. So let's get to Mapelo's one first, and then we'll see. These voice notes from both of them. All right. So how does this thing go? Let's just see if we can get these to work. Hang on a second. Mapelo first. Now it's not playing. Great. Oh, God. It's like technically we've got such issues this morning.
You've got to love technology.
Wait a second. I'll just start this up on my own. On a separate thing, and then we'll get it going. I can't rely on I can't rely on the software that Steve Jobs' people have put on here. I've got to do it myself. All right, so here's Mapelo. Take it away, Mapelo. There we go.
Morning, everyone. It's Mapelo here. I'd like to know, did Ben have anything to do with the Steinhoff documentary on Showmax? Because when that Steinhoff scandal came out, Ben had this to say.
Is that the Steinhoff's accounting scandal dates further back than we actually think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This I reckon, just gets... please, Showmax or whoever, please make a series about this.
Steinhoff, yeah.
Because it could be the SS version of, like, House of Cards or whatever. You can call it what you want, but like, I mean, I reckon there's a story here.
As much as we appreciate Tully's wedding diaries, can we also just have this?
So, I mean, there was a lot of talk last...
Like, really? I guess that was... Ben's original idea. They stole it from Ben. If he had nothing to do with it, with that documentary.
Wouldn't be the first time that we have had a discussion about something and then suddenly some other media organization comes up with a good idea. I haven't seen the Steinheist documentary yet, but I've got to watch it, because even Dr. Hanan told me it's a really interesting thing to watch. So with that kind of recommendation, I'll get into it. But yeah, there's Ben basically saying a couple of years before they made it, that this would be a great documentary. So I'll tell him when we get him on the show again. He was right then. One other quick voice note here. This is from Brandon checking in on the team and stating how he feels politically drained. So here's Brandon. Brandon, take it away. What's on your mind this morning?
Hey, Gareth and the Cliff Central team. This is Brandon. I can't recall hearing any voice notes on the show in the last couple of days, so hopefully that feature hasn't been cancelled. Thought I'll send a quick note just to echo some of the sentiment that you've been voicing, Gareth, around politics and government, not only locally, but internationally. I think we have very few leaders or even a political system at this stage that inspires. So I'm fairly disillusioned and politically fatigued. I couldn't give a shit about what the ANC or the DA is doing, you know? Stop the talking and start the walking. Anyway, hope you folks are doing well and that your listeners are going to have a great week ahead. All the best.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Also, tired of the politicians. Let's just say that maybe from December on, we do not listen to the politicians at all. Let's see if our lives improve. We can all put this into place. For December. So no matter what the presidents or the politicians all over the world have to say about things, we ignore them completely for the month of December. Let's see if our lives get better or worse. I can pretty much predict where it's going to go. Okay.
Which will be better. It's December. There's nothing that can go wrong in the month of December. Like, in fact, by the time when November's done, the year is done. Like, we're done. We're just coming into the office just to show face for the first 2 weeks, just to be like, I'll be out of office. And then it's tickets. You're not going to get anyone. No one's doing work. People are leaving at 1 o'clock. They're closing laptops.
But since
the year's come to an end.
Let's
guys.
Be honest. Even this stuff starts to happen in November for most people. I mean, a lot of offices.
Yes.
I was driving around in Santon last week, Thursday, I think it was. I went to one appointment that I had there. I just realized, like, this is the CBD of the busiest city in South Africa, right? And there was so little activity going on. I suddenly thought, this is meant to be the middle of the day in the supposedly most important square mile of Johannesburg, where all the business takes place, and there was nothing going on. And it made me a little bit nervous, I won't lie, because it's not December yet. You can tell that people are obviously on a bit of a go slow for November. We obviously had 2.5 years of COVID and weird stuff. Most of the offices shut down and all that kind of thing. But really, this shouldn't be how it looks already. That's all I'm saying. Every day, the entire day, my variety of music is always on. Can't imagine life without music of any kind, says Dear Linda. You know what? I found, like, there are some places where in my day I need music, even though I love podcasts. And even though I've started listening to audiobooks again, which I love, there are some times where you just want music. You don't want, especially because we work with podcasts all day, Simpiwe. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be listening to podcasts all day, every day as well. Although to me, there's a lot more mental stimulation to that kind of thing than music. There are some times where you just want a little bit of music.
Yes. And I'm someone who still is following, like, who dropped an album this week. Like, Drake and 21 recently dropped an album together. And I'm like, okay, I need to give that a listen. I need to know what's going on in the hip-hop world. And there's a trend on TikTok where Drake said a line, and now everyone is kind of just, like, making that line seem as if he was, like, a bit more feminine when he said it, because it's like, 21, can you tell me something? Everyone's just ripping Drake. Like, they're just ripping him. They're like, oh, yeah, when he was in the studio, I bet you he was just twerking when he said that, like, 21, can you tell me something?
didn't Drake just he did something really interesting. He, like, went on a fake press tour where he basically,
yes,
he stayed at home, but he pretended that he was being interviewed by all these people. So he would cut questions out of all the famous, like, late night shows and the big radio shows in America, big podcasters. And then he would pretend that he was answering their questions. But actually, it was just like fake interviews. And people bought them hook, line, and sinker. They thought it was real. And he didn't even leave his house.
He even did performances, fake performances, like on the SNL show, where they had Michael B. Jordan kind of announce and be like, oh, Drake and 21 performing one of the greatest songs that have dropped in the 21st century. And then boom, there they are performing. And then people are like, wait, when did Drake and 21 perform on SNL? Like,
that's so great.
They're ripping everyone. And I was like, okay, this is how you do it. Like, now we're talking about you. Now we want to know what's going on. Like, okay, is this album a banger? Let's hear it. So I think that was a great marketing thing that they did.
That is so clever. I love that. You know, it makes so much sense that, you know, the media is, we've been doing the same things on TV and in radio for 100 years. And then a guy like Drake comes along and shows just how much bullshit there is going on over there, right?
Yeah, and he doesn't care. Like, honestly, he's just like, I'm living my best life. I have money. And then the cover art for the new album was really dope to even find out. So it's a picture of this lady. I forgot her name. And it was taken about 3 years ago by one of his friends. And then he saw it and he was like, oh, I love the authenticness. And that's how they got the cover art. And I was like, oh, okay, look at you.
Well, this has got to be a big wake up call to everybody that you don't even have to leave your house. You can do performances on SNL. You can be interviewed by all the greatest people in the world, and you do not have to leave your house. And you can make it look like you're traveling the whole world doing this press tour. Meanwhile, you're doing nothing. You're sitting at home with your, I don't know, your cup of tea in your hand.
And you know what's even better? You can buy a verification badge to make it all look legit.
Legit.
I mean, does it not get any better?
Are you going to buy yourself a verification badge for Christmas, Simpiwe? Is that one of your gifts to yourself?
No, I don't have that kind of money to waste, especially in dollars. No.
Let me just see.
I saw a trend on TikTok where some lady was ripping a guy for, like, chasing coins. After he's dropped it, and it's like, oh, That is so ghetto. I would never do that. I was like, honey, we live in Cyril's economy. I'm picking up every coin.
Uh-huh.
I'm picking up a 1 rand, a 5 rand, a 2 rand. Maybe a 5 up. We can leave that. But any other coin, honey, child, gotta get that money. Pick it up.
When last did you even see a 1 or 2 cent? Because we used to make 1 and 2 cent coins. You don't get them. Nobody even sees them anymore. They don't exist.
Yeah.
They've gone out of circulation. Mm-hmm. Just quickly, if you did buy a verification badge, it would cost you just under 150 Rand a month. That's how much it would cost you to have that. So think about it.
So much money. You can buy petrol and get, what, 3 liters, 4 liters for that? Come on, guys.
I don't know.
Let's get serious.
Not a lot. Not a lot. All right. It is time for us to get to an episode of Blind History, where we talk this morning about probably the most impressive sailor of all time. In world history, but certainly the greatest British sailor. His adventures, his tactical genius, and his courage have inspired Britain to become the greatest naval superpower of the world. Well, it certainly was at the time in the 1700s and 1800s. And it helped to bring about the fall of Napoleon and a big change in the balance of power throughout the world. Now, although he had only one eye and one arm, he seems to have had enough energy and ambition for 2 lifetimes, and history looks pretty fondly on his contribution. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about none other than Vice Admiral Viscount Horatio Nelson. And here he is in our latest episode of Blind History with me and with Anthony Medera. Don't go anywhere. CliffCentral.com, Tuesday morning. There was hardly a breath of wind. Most of the ships weren't moving at all. But there was still the mayhem of battle, cannons and muskets being fired at close range.
Fire!
Officers shouting commands, pierced by the cries of the wounded. While the conflict raged, a one-eyed, one-armed master and commander stood on the quarterdeck of his ship, contemplating his fleet's next move. In his distinctive blue coat, bicorn hat, and diamond cockade, it was clear to everyone in Europe that he was Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson. The problem was that it was also clear to a sniper high in the rigging of the French warship Redoutable. He took aim, squeezed the trigger, and in a single moment, decided the fate of the greatest sailor in the world. The most noble Lord Horatio Nelson, Viscount and Baron Nelson of the Nile and of Burnham Thorpe in the county of Norfolk, Baron Nelson of the Nile and of Hillsborough in the said county, Knight of the Most Honourable Order of the Bath, Vice Admiral of the White Squadron of the Fleet, Commander-in-Chief of His Majesty's Ships in the Mediterranean, Duke of Bronte in the Kingdom of Sicily, Knight Grand Cross of the Sicilian Order of St. Ferdinand, and of Merit, Member of the Ottoman Order of the Crescent, Knight Grand Commander of the Order of St. Joachim. He would have liked that as an intro.
He would have.
Because he was a vain bastard.
He was very ambitious.
And he liked titles and decorations and laudable acceptance from a crowd. So here he is, Lord Horatio Nelson, known as Nelson to history. The only other Nelson that you can really say has broken through all the other uses of that name is our own Nelson Mandela, who tangentially was probably named after him. At least that was his English name that was given to him while he was at missionary school. But this is the famous British hero, probably the most famous sailor in history.
Yes, the most famous sailor in history. And if we just step back to 1758 in Norfolk, as you mentioned in his titles, he born 7 weeks prematurely, tiny baby.
They didn't think he was going to last.
So they baptized him straight after his birth because they didn't think he was going to survive. And he was always sickly. And he was a small boy and actually ended up being a small man. I think it was 5'4", but the strength of character and the size of his heart was just overpowering to achieve what he did.
You've just gone to the start of his life as this premature, weak baby. And I'm just going to fast forward quickly to towards the end of his life. And we were talking about a haggard, scarred 47-year-old, one eye, one arm, couldn't really hear properly either because of all the cannon fire, was, let's say, less than good to his wife, Fanny, although she wasn't particularly honest with him either. These are the stories that remind you that sometimes you get stuck in a body where the spirit is greater than the physical presence. You know, this guy, if he'd been in a stronger body, who knows what he could have achieved.
That's true.
But as you say, born premature and ending up with, you know, one of everything rather than two.
Yeah.
This poor man, he must have been quite a sight towards the end of his life.
Yeah, I mean, I think his lover mentioned the sight when she saw him coming in. And also, he played a little bit of a role in his own demise, probably because he was a very aggressive admiral, but also he loved, you know, his ego, he loved to dress.
Oh, yeah.
So he stood out. So the sniper, it was quite easy to find him.
Well, we've kind of done a bit of a spoiler there on how it all ends, but let's go back to the beginning. This is a guy who also clearly, he showed a lot of intelligence. His father was a priest. His mom died when he was very young. So he grew up with tremendous ambition, but he also showed himself to be quite fearless. And what was normal then is for kids to enroll in the Navy at a very young age. You know, they became kind of almost like servants to officers on the ships. And that's how they learnt to become sailors.
I found that very unusual, age 12.
12.
Which is insane.
I mean, you think about a 12-year-old now, and they're taken away from their parents, put on a vessel. He was always seasick, by the way. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I also heard about that.
He had seasickness from the moment he first boarded a ship at age 12.
And he struggled through his life.
All the way through to the end of his life. You would think a sailor, because people usually go, oh, I don't get seasick, so I'd probably make a good sailor. Here's the greatest sailor in the world, seasick the whole way through his life. So it's not true.
He made it work.
Yeah. I mean, listen, he also traveled far and wide. I mean, he spent an enormous amount of time in the Caribbean, in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Cayman Islands, Tenerife, the Mediterranean, went off to the Nile and fought Napoleon. Mm. Really an incredibly full life, even in his 47 years.
But it was, you know, his career was shaped. There was a little bit of luck at least because, so I'm not sure what his relationship was like with his dad, but his mom died, like you mentioned, early. And there was nothing left for him. So that's why, you know, he ended up joining the Navy at such a young age. But his mom's brother, so his uncle, was Captain Maurice Suckling. And he took him under his wing. And he spent his teenage years at least with him, learning. So first of all, technically learning in the Thames, and then also just going out to sea. So he spent his life on the sea, especially his teenage life on the sea with his uncle. And I think that made a massive difference to you know, the rest of his life and how he lived his life. But his mom dying young played out a lot. He was always looking for attention. It was, you know, he had some tough lives in those days. It wasn't easy.
Absolutely. Interesting that he was in the Navy, learned how to be an able seaman, ended up being, you know, promoted quite quickly through the ranks as he went on and fought battles and took chances. And,
well, lieutenant at 14.
And disobeyed his superiors very often.
Yeah,
but when proven to have made the right decision, was rewarded rather than scolded. And of course, in those days, what we've got to remember from a context point of view is that the British Navy was coming into its real power. There wasn't, at that stage, any serious competitor to the Spanish, who'd been in charge of the seas for years, still had the biggest ships and all the rest of it. But the British had grown a very significant navy. They also had possessions all over the world that they had to patrol and trade with. And so shipping became an important part of the British economy and their military outlook. And really, during the course of Nelson's life, I think they reached their apex. Mm. And the British Navy was then established as the most powerful navy in the world for maybe 100, perhaps even 200 years after that.
Mm.
So it was a significant time for someone to have joined the Navy. This was the place and the time to make your name in the Navy. And yeah, if he'd been born 100 years earlier or 50 years later, he might not have been the hero that he was.
And then also, I think he was one of the reasons why they reached their zenith. It was because of just his amazing skill. And he could preempt, he felt exactly what was going to happen.
Well, they teach a lot of Napoleon's skills in like leadership school and all the rest of it, but they also teach a lot of Nelson's stuff. And really, in some ways, people always try to put Nelson and Napoleon up as, you know, two poles of a battle that was going on at the time. And you asked the question of me just before we started the recording. You said, you know, Wellington or Nelson? And we'll save the answer for the end of the podcast, because I think everybody who, you know, is interested in that period of history has got thoughts about that.
Mm.
And also, they were around at the time of Napoleon.
Yeah.
A good adversary makes for good heroes.
Yeah. But I think when we get to it a little bit later in discussion, just to discuss around Napoleon, because Napoleon was the first to admit that he that his navy was shocking. And, you know, his naval officers, they knew what was good for them, and that not engage with Nelson. So you would find out where these idiots were, and they weren't engaging in order to flip and kill them. So he really struggled, because he had superiority on land, but he could not get it in the sea. And that was actually a big part that allowed Wellington finally to hit the nail in the coffin.
So for starters, he went off to the West Indies, where, you know, there was a lot of British naval activity. There were also a lot of pirates there at that time, but it was really between them and the Spanish. The nice thing about being in the Navy at that time, if you commanded a vessel and you captured another vessel, you got a large percentage of the loot. So you got to just, whatever's on that ship, if it was gold, you got to keep some of the gold as the commanding officer, and all the sailors on your ship got a smaller percentage. But you made your money this way, because it paid you as a naval officer, but the real money was in scoring booty, you know?
He wasn't that interested in the money, it seems.
No, but he was quite interested in this girl who he met, called Fanny, great name. She was from what seemed like a very nice family. Her father was a minor colonial official. He promised Nelson a nice dowry, lots of money, if he married Fanny. Nelson said, sure. And it transpired just before they got married that the whole thing was made up. He didn't have any money, the father. Fanny was infertile, so she couldn't have children. And Nelson, being an honorable guy, still went through with the marriage.
Okay, so I didn't pick that up, because there was a child, so maybe it was
not from her.
Okay,
no,
that's incredible.
She she couldn't bear children, and she kept it secret from him.
Really?
Yeah.
And so, and just interestingly enough, just on that point, his best man was William the Fourth.
Right. Who was then called, I mean, he was also called Sailor Bill own family, because he loved, you know, the Navy, and he was on the ships a lot of the time. But yeah, that's interesting.
And she lied to him.
She lied to him. So there's a lot of stuff to discuss there, you know, and from a psychological point of view, what that means.
Yeah, because importantly, later on, it definitely plays a role.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they didn't really... There was a lot of romance in the beginning. She was apparently very pretty. She was apparently very lovely. He was always attracted to highly intelligent and beautiful women. I mean, who isn't? So he chose well there, but he had no idea that she was keeping these secrets from him. Anyway, he married her, and they ended up remaining married until his death, even though they fell out of love and things started to go south quite quickly when she moved back to England.
Okay, so when he was in the West Indies, so he did have a lot of run-ins with either the Admiralty or with some of the top brass in the areas that he was operating in. And I think that this is an area, that, a time of his life where he ended up with quite a lot of depression post this. During the time of the war, the American War of Independence, and it had just ended and the British were now in control. So there were certain things that weren't allowed to be done. So from a trading perspective,
now, Americans couldn't trade with British colonies.
Correct. The trade embargo.
Yeah.
100%. And so he strictly enforced it. And then, much to the disgust, because everybody was on the take and corrupt in that area. And so they complained bitterly to the Admiralty about his behavior. And he ended up basically being shipped back home and, spent the next 5 years back at his hometown in Norfolk at half pay. Because of these things, and they did play up.
Well, apparently he was also a bit of a disciplinarian. He liked keeping everybody on the ship fit. They had to do exercise every day. He made sure that they, you know, if there's anyone who was insubordinate, they were immediately flogged. And really, you know, despite the fact that later on in his career, he had huge loyalty from his commanders and his ordinary sailors, because he treated them all very well. You know, he dined with them the night before his final battle and that kind of thing. But he also looked after the ordinary sailors and they looked up to him. But in the beginning of his career, he was very strict about things. He said, there are rules. We don't break the rules. And this goes to what you were saying about the trade embargo.
Yeah, and I suppose that hurt his career.
Yeah.
But
because most of them were corrupt.
Correct. Exactly. And then also that there was a situation, he also mishandled a delicate situation with the prince, as we just mentioned, who was his best man at his wedding, William Henry, who later became, you know, William the Fourth. And he got involved in a dispute with his first lieutenant. This is William now. And he didn't want to, he allowed the young prince to get away with it a bit, you know, because he just saw him as a very important person and he didn't want to, you know, fall foul of it at that particular time. So ultimately in the end, he was unimpressed. The Admiralty were very unimpressed and he was basically sent home and he was lingering around on half pay for the next 5 years.
Luckily for him, Napoleon was on the move. Well, this is long before Napoleon was well known. But one of his first jobs as a French artillery officer was to besiege the port of Toulon, which was an important place where the French fleet would be harbored. Napoleon was very good at setting up the siege. He was excellent at arranging the cannon. Little did Nelson know and little did Napoleon know that at this stage, while they were both young, they would be facing each other for the first time here. And the British managed to blockade the port. Successfully, Napoleon managed to besiege Toulon successfully. They both had victories to boast about from that, but they didn't actually meet at that point. They probably never did meet. I think Nelson only ever met Wellington once before he died. So all of these great men, while their paths crossed, they didn't actually
meet on the battlefield.
Yeah. So that was his first proper.
And this is also where he, around that time, is where he lost sight in his right eye.
So
from dust, he went into a land battle.
He was very gung ho. So he disembarked and actually led a charge on land, and a cannonball hit some sandbags and sprayed sand and stone and obviously, you know, there was gunpowder and all the rest of it into his eye, damaged his optic nerve. He could never see out of his right eye ever again. That was the first of his major problems from a physical point of view after
a battle. He used it quite cleverly in a battle later on, one of his other famous battles.
Yeah, he was in Copenhagen where he was taking on the Danish fleet. It was his idea to get them before they even left the port to join the Russians. And he just ignored a signal from his commanding officer to do what the commanding officer
to pull out, right?
Essentially to retreat, and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I must have used the telescope on my bad eye, so I couldn't see the signal."
Does that term "turn a blind eye" come from that?
It may well. I'm not entirely sure, but he certainly did that, and he would. He had a good sense of humor about it. He also lost his arm later on in another land battle that didn't go so well. It seems he was fine on the sea. As soon as he went onto the land, bad things happened.
But this particular battle he felt terrible about because he lost men and he lost his arm. And so it's one of the few defeats that he had in his career. But apparently they amputated his arm without any sedation?
No, there was nothing. Listen, we're talking about medicine, in inverted commas. They didn't know about bacteria or infections or any of that stuff. So the only thing you could do if someone's arm bone, his humerus, was splintered by cannon and musket fire and all the rest of it, so all they could do is cut it off. So it was cut off sort of between the elbow and the shoulder, and they would saw through it with like a, you know, the kind of saw, like a jigsaw that you would use to cut wood, and you'd have to, they'd take a scarf or something, put it between your teeth, you'd bite down on this thing. If you were lucky, they'd give you some brandy or something to kind of numb it, but you'd need a lot of brandy to not feel that. And then they'd saw through your bone, and that was, there goes Nelson's arm, and then they just threw it overboard.
And then the next day I was back on top. That's just insane. I can't believe it.
So, all right, we're talking about a guy now who's definitely seen some action. We're going to condense a lot of the amazing travels that he did. I mean, he chased Villeneuve, the French admiral, across the Atlantic and back again. He went up into the Baltic to fight the Danes in Copenhagen. Yes. He was often around Spanish ships laden with gold on the, you know, the western coast of Europe. And also famously fought at the Battle of the Nile, where he led a whole bunch of British ships into what the French thought was a completely defensible position. In fact, the French were so confident that the British wouldn't get through that they put all of their firepower on the port side of the ship. Yeah. And he snuck through and started attacking them on the starboard side, and they had no defense planned.
That was his most complete victory. And it just completely threw Napoleon's Egyptian campaign, just threw it in the bush.
Yeah.
And you know,
disaster.
That was a tough thing in Napoleon's career. You know, when we talk about Napoleon, his career, that Egyptian disaster was tough for him. And Nelson played a massive role in that. And he had to sneak around and escape because Nelson was looking for him.
That's right.
And he had to sneak around and he did actually get back to France. But that was one of his greatest victories. And I think that what's important to note here is that strategically, and we've spoken about a lot of great military tacticians many, many times on our podcasts. And he was his tactics, they were brilliant. So far advanced of what people were used to. Fighting in lines versus bringing boats on either side. Not being scared to go in shallow water. In Copenhagen, they went into very shallow water and his enemy got stuck. And his head of command, because he wasn't allowed, because they thought, you know, they were always grumpy with him. The guys back in England, that he said all Nelson's ships have run aground, and that's why he raised the flag. But ultimately, it was these guys, and Nelson had maneuvered them into shallow waters in their own port.
Yeah.
So
which
he was.
They should have known better.
Well, they should have known better. So technically, he was incredible.
And it's almost like he could figure out what their game plan was before anything had happened.
Mm.
So he could almost foresee what was going to happen and managed to counteract all their moves. And it drove them crazy. Now, Napoleon was as good on land, but there really weren't many people in all of naval history who could say that they had this ability to plot an enemy's move before they'd even made it.
And if you look at Villeneuve, I mean, Villeneuve had the wrath of Napoleon.
Oof.
You know, if he had the communication that we have today, I think every second, every minute, Napoleon would have been screaming at him on the phone because he...
Abusive boss.
Yeah, you know, they said, no, we know we're going to be killed, so we're actually not even going into battle. That was the French Navy strategy. And it just drove him mad that he could never get a strong navy to support his land battles. And Nelson, you know, the barriers to entry for these guys to get anywhere was extremely high.
Well, he was mostly the lord of the Mediterranean for that period. And, you know, the British controlled the seas. And it was very difficult for anyone to move a ship in or out of, you know, the Straits of Gibraltar or the Bosphorus or anywhere else at this point without Nelson knowing about it. And while he was there, something interesting happened. He went off to Naples and he met William Hamilton, who was the British ambassador to Naples, and William Hamilton's wife, who was a certain Lady Alexandra. What was her name?
Emma
Hamilton. That's right. Lady Emma Hamilton, apparently also beautiful and intelligent. Tick those two boxes. So, you know, Nelson's interest was piqued. And he immediately started an affair with her. And it was a very public affair. Everyone in the world seems to have known it was going on. Mm. William was apparently okay with it. They kind of formed this throuple and lived together for quite a long time.
It was exactly like that. It seemed, you know, he knew about it. And I think he'd almost accepted it because I think he really loved Emma Hamilton. And he said, look, I'm not going to be able to keep her. But I will be able to keep her in this type of environment. Nelson's married. So I think it just worked. at the time. But the press, I don't know what you would call it in those days. I mean, it was properly frowned upon.
Well, I mean, during his life, because he was such a hero, I think he and Emma got away with it. But as soon as he died, they turned on her horribly. Mm. They called her an adulterer. And, you know, they had a daughter called Horatia, who was clearly Nelson's daughter. She ended up having 10 kids. She died in the late 1800s. But, you know, she was essentially treated quite badly too, even though all Nelson wanted, he said, despite not changing his will, he said, please just look after Emma and my daughter. Mm. It's all he wanted in his final wishes while he was dying on that ship at the end. But we'll get to that in a second. So essentially, Nelson rises up the ranks. He was a bit pissed off that they made him a baron. He thought he deserved higher than that
on Viscount.
On the rank. Yeah, he wanted to be a Viscount. He thought that was probably better. But he probably thought even more. Mm. He probably expected to be, you know, made a duke like Wellington would be. Didn't happen. He also thought that, you know, being Sir at an early, relatively early stage of his career was also a bit cheeky. He expected more from that too. And he liked hanging around with very powerful, very connected people. He also loved when people clapped and cheered for him. And for a while, he did a tour of England where he was very well received. Mm. So people really celebrated him as a hero. And they needed good news at that point. Napoleon was victorious everywhere in Europe. It looked like, you know, it was going to be a whitewash for him. And essentially, you know, Nelson was this one star in an otherwise quite dark sky for them.
And, you know, he built this PR machine around himself that played a big role in being as famous as he was. He really knew how to play this.
Yeah, and there weren't a lot of celebrities around at that time.
No.
He milked it for all it was worth.
100%, yes.
So let's fast forward to the last chapter of his life, because we could talk about each of his battles and his genius and all of them. I think we've covered a few of those. But the final battle was at Trafalgar. What makes this such an interesting battle is it really was decisive. It was all about control of the seas. And it couldn't have been a greater apex moment for any sailor than it was for Nelson. So he was on his ship, the Victory. He had told all of his sailors they weren't allowed to climb up into the rigging and fire muskets like the French were, because he was worried that they would set fire to the sails. So it was kind of easy to see what was going on his ship. The French at this point were desperate. They had been broadsided. Most of their ships were on fire.
Yeah, from both sides. Yeah.
The English had waged a far superior battle on the French, and they had no way of fighting it. They also had better ships, faster ships. The French were kind of big and you know, heavy. They didn't move quickly enough. They were commanded by inexperienced sailors, and they knew they were an inferior navy to the French. But there were all these guys in the rigging, and they could kind of spot Nelson standing on the quarter deck in his famous blue coat.
With that big diamond on his hat.
Right.
That he was given by that.
Correct. Kind of like a sitting duck.
Mm.
And one of the sailors on the Redoutable just took a pot shot, hit him, and it got him right in the spinal cord. He was immediately disabled, fell down, and took a long while to die, but got to see victory.
Yeah.
And he got famously to utter his last words, which were, "Thank God I've done my duty," and knew that the English had properly beaten the French at this seminal battle. So in some way, it is a poetic ending for him. He was buried in St. Paul's Cathedral in a tomb which you can still go and visit. It's one of the grandest tombs in England. It was originally intended for Henry VIII.
That's true.
And it's now
Cardinal
Wolsey.
But then
Henry
wants it. Henry took it. And then in there buried Nelson in it.
And really, there hasn't been, or there wasn't, an English funeral, a public funeral, as big as Nelson's, probably until Princess Diana.
Yeah, and the amount of people that just left St. Paul's Cathedral walking around, and the people hadn't even left. It was just insane because it was a different era.
Sure.
And there wasn't TVs or anything like that in those days, but there was just massive, massive sadness. The nation just mourned. They were mourning a hero, and his team, you know, that that were with him. They were just mourning him as a man. He was an incredible leader. And it was such a loss.
His statue is probably in the most central place in all of London. You know, Trafalgar Square, which is named after that battle, and Nelson's Column in the middle of it. It's a meeting place. It's a central public square of London. It's also, you know, famous for all the most important protests. And our South Africa House, our embassy, is right on Trafalgar Square. Canada House is there too, the British Museum. It's an incredible place. And he's been honored throughout history. You know, Winston Churchill said he was an inspiration of his during the Second World War. There are so many things named after him all over the world.
Yeah. And also some of the rituals in the Navy. So the blood of Nelson, so where they drink brandy, because they embalmed him, his body, when at the end of the battle, they embalmed him in brandy to keep him fresh. But the challenge was that the brandy swelled his face so much that they covered it at the funeral. So it backfired a little bit. But now they're still doing it to this day, where they drink the blood of Nelson.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of these things, whenever I think of the British Navy, I think of that, which is like the famous sailor song. And I'm sure that this guy epitomizes all of that more than anyone else.
Yeah.
I mentioned at the beginning of this that you'd asked me a question before we started recording. Who was the greater military hero?
Yes.
Wellington or Nelson? What do you think?
Well, I've looked a lot into both of them, and it's just so difficult because the one fought on land, the other one fought in the sea. They both had great strategies. The thing is, I'd go with Nelson. And
okay, so then Nelson and Napoleon.
Well, Napoleon's a hero of mine.
it's a tough one.
It is a tough one, but I mean, Napoleon didn't have anything on Nelson when it came to. You know, it looked like he was coming out in his Lilo, you know, so these are just such a good question. I don't know how to answer them because
I think it all depends on where. Like if I were at sea in the 1800s, I would want Nelson in charge.
Agreed.
If I were on land, I'd want Napoleon on charge, in charge. Or Wellington, who ultimately beat Napoleon.
Yeah.
You know, but while Napoleon was in his heyday, he was unstoppable, and Nelson was the same.
I think that Napoleon, you know, he was definitely a military man, but he was also looking big picture strategy, whereas Wellington was a military man.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nelson, for that matter, just knew what he and what was great about Nelson was that he would, well, let me just be careful when I say great, but he would annihilate a lot. Often his predecessors would say, yes, we'll just rattle them up a bit. And he would say, no, we need to annihilate them. You know, so he wouldn't be happy with anything less.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cliffcentral.com.